Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday afternoon. Social historian and curator of civil conversations, Rick Perlstein, is with us this hour. His latest book is The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. He's also author of Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America, and Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus. Rick has written essays for a number of publications and book reviews for The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Nation, Village Voice, Slate. He grew up in Milwaukee, and he really knows this city. He was just talking about it, and we're delighted to have him with us. We're also, because we're close to an election, I think there might be something to learn from the past in terms of how elections went this week, and we'll ask him to put on that analyst hat as well. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Rick is an interesting writer. He's a historian. He really knows the period we're looking at is specific. It's 1973 to 1976, but it, of course, takes in what happened before 73 and certainly what happened with Ronald Reagan after 1976 and maybe what happened with the whole conservative movement and conservatism in this country, which is obviously still very, very strong. So he looks at TV shows and magazines and events that were going on during this period. It's really a social history in addition to a historical look, particularly at Ronald Reagan. And thank you so much, Rick, for being with us.
Kathleen, it's a thrill to be here.
It's a lovely way to write because you're not only looking at the history of somebody, and we get a really good biography of Ronald Reagan, but mm-hmm. you're looking at all that, and you're reminding me of all that was going on in this country at that particular time, too. You really cover it all, don't you?
Yeah, Reagan's on the cover, but it's really about us. You know, yeah. why do we go into that direction, and instead of what we're kind of poised to do, as I start the book, which is kind of take a really hard look at America, at this notion that America was God's chosen nation, and it was a kind of argument that went on during the period that I'm writing in. About.
Yeah.
I'm writing in this period in which these arguments are still salient.
And when you look at 1973, you start the book with the POWs mm-hmm. returning, the party at the White House that Richard Nixon, Reagan's comments on the Vietnam War and later on Richard Nixon and Watergate. But this sort of manufactured in a way because
right.
it wasn't really a pretty picture. The deaths in Vietnam,
right.
the money that we spent in Vietnam, the POWs were troubled, those who came home. And yet we tried to put this glossy picture on, oh, this is America. Here they are, your heroes. We
right.
welcome you with open arms.
Right. What happened was these poor guys who were fighter pilots and bombers, you know, were shot down over Vietnam and they were kept as prisoner. And until 1969, they were treated terribly and tortured and formed this really heroic kind of civilization. They would communicate with each other through kind of a Morse code that they invented. Interestingly enough, they stopped being tortured in 1969. And I wrote in the book that no one knew why. Tom Hayden, the old New Left activist, told me he knows why. We went to North Vietnam and convinced the communists that torturing was a bad idea and that they were going to lose in global opinion, and then they stopped. That was interesting. But, of course, the Vietnam War was widely understood to be a terrible waste, you know, just a complete this country that had pulled together to defeat Hitler, you know, and built this great civilization that was the envy of the world really seemed to have kind of gone down a moral sinkhole with the Vietnam War. And when Richard Nixon finally ended the war in January of 1973, he went on TV and proclaimed that he had achieved a peace with honor, mm-hmm. which was a very controversial proposition. And one of the things they did to kind of make the political argument, and I uncovered documents exposing the fact that this is what they were trying to do, was create this kind of propaganda campaign around the Vietnam prisoners of war who returned and were heroic and by anyone's estimation, but they were really kind of mobilized, actually not by anyone's estimation, we can talk about that, but were kind of mobilized as these kind of avatars of an America that had really kind of won in Vietnam, that it's kept its stiff upper lip and its backbone. And a lot of people rejected it. It was very fascinating to see that kind of mainstream kind of political columnists in tabloid newspapers. I quote Jimmy Breslin from the New York Daily
sure.
News, saying, well, I don't see what all the fuss is about. these POWs, it reminded me of when I waited for a friend of mine to come back from Sing Sing. You know, these guys are murderers. They were committing war crimes. You know, they were strafing, you know, peasant villages. You know, they were bombing civilians in Hanoi. So you really had this argument going on really deep within even the popular culture. I mean, think of MASH, right? This hit TV show that was going on at that time in which the good guys were the guys who never followed orders. Mm-hmm. And the bad guy was the spit and shine kind of John Wayne officer, you know, Frank Burns, who was the butt of every joke because he did all the stuff according to the rules. You know, he did the stuff our father did, which is, you know, like separate the good guys from the bad guys. And if you in that show were behaving the way a hero in World War II did, you were a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the argument that America was having between these two ways of looking at America, two ways of looking at American patriotism, mm-hmm. whether it was about waving the flag or criticizing the country to make it better.
And then we moved into Watergate. Oh,
right.
My goodness. I lived through that time, and what a time that was. Again, it was interesting to because I wasn't aware of these Ronald Reagan's comments about mm-hmm. Watergate and how Saturday Night Massacre wasn't a big thing, and he just sort of saw a kind of weird patriotism among the Watergate burglars.
He said that they were not criminals at heart.
Isn't that interesting that he had that take? And here we are, you know, this greatest crisis in American democracy,
right.
with everybody doing all of this soul-searching, deep
yes.
soul-searching.
And he didn't think it was a crisis at all.
He didn't. And obviously a lot of people probably wanted to go that direction or they would have remembered what he had said. Instead, we latched on to this optimism, everything's going to be okay, we're through, our great
right.
national nightmare is over,
right.
everything is fine now. Instead of what can we learn from this,
right.
let's explore the depth of how things went really bad with Vietnam and with Watergate.
Right. And to me, what Reagan's ascension in these years and then later represented, among many other things, one was a criticism of the excess of liberalism, which you know probably was salutary in some ways. But another thing that it was really kind of turning its back on this process of the country maturing, you know, thinking about itself as one country among other countries. There's a great quote I got from one of the POWs, and they were not all proud of what they'd done. You know, some had joined the anti-war movement while they were in the prisoner of war camps, and they were ostracized by the patriotic officers in the POW camps, and one was ostracized so mercilessly that he committed suicide.
Mm.
But one of the POWs who came back, they were kind of embraced by popular culture as people who had not experienced the 60s. So they were these pure innocents. There was an entire episode, 2 hours long, that I studied of the Today Show in which the hosts of the Today Show kind of explained to the POWs what they'd missed, you know, all this chaos in the society. And one of them said, well, I like what's happened to the country because we've thrown away our Linus security blankets. You know, this whole idea that we were acting like grown-ups was embraced by a lot of people and it was rejected by a lot of people.
Right. I can't believe you watched the – that's the kind of book it is. I'm trying to describe it. And Rick has just told you why this is a different kind of history because you watched the Today Show.
That's right.
And many other programs for
yes.
2 hours.
Gene Shalit with his big,
oh,
bushy
my
microphone.
Gosh. And Gene
talking
Shalit.
About Erica Jong.
And Erica Jong, Fear of Flying. I remember.
That's right.
Did that book come out in the 70s?
Oh, I think it – well, I think it came out a little later. Actually, what I remember specifically was a Jane Pauley describing Last Tango in Paris.
Oh, my.
And saying, well, you know, the movies aren't quite like – I think she said something like, well, the most popular movie last year was The Godfather, in which it, you know, questioned, you know, whether America wasn't kind of a, you know, mafia nation. And the most popular movie when you guys were captured in 1965 was Mary Poppins or something like that.
All right, let's move into Ronald Reagan. And I would imagine he is a hero to so many people that you're getting some – probably criticism from conservatives because he is a hero. He's
yes.
quoted all the time.
They're proving the point of the book. I mean, my argument
exactly.
is that Reagan became a way of people sort of evading this kind of reckoning and became a very important part of people's identity. These kind of negative feelings around the country were incredibly uncomfortable for
mm-hmm.
people. And one of the things that Reagan did, among other things, was he relieved people of that kind of moral responsibility to think about what America had become.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people really can't stand that message
mm-hmm.
because he means so much to them. He's the person who tells them that they're okay, that America's okay, that the world I grew up in is okay. And someone pointed out, well, my first book was about Barry Goldwater and conservatives embraced it because he was kind of a lovable loser. My second book was about Richard Nixon and a lot of conservatives embraced it because Richard Nixon, of course, was this villain, this goat. But once I, you know, looked at Reagan in a 360-degree portrait, it became a different matter altogether. And it's not like all conservatives have rejected it. I got a wonderful review from Max Boot, the neoconservative commentator in the Wall Street Journal. I got a good review from Christopher Caldwell, who's a longtime writer for the Weekly Standard. But a lot of them are like it's fascinating to see how they mistake description for prescription. Mm-hmm. I'm describing the arguments over Ronald Reagan. I'm describing the complexities of Ronald Reagan. And a lot of the conservative response is, well, he just doesn't understand how great Ronald Reagan is, so he must not be a regular American.
Oh, interesting. I was interviewing, and I'm so glad you have a picture because it really epitomizes Ronald Reagan to many, I think, where he's a lifeguard. And
right.
I remember interviewing his son on what would have been his 100th birthday.
Ron Reagan wrote a wonderful
book about his dad and talked about how
calm, zen-like book.
Absolutely. And really said, I think that may have been the job that my dad liked the most, was being a lifeguard. And it really describes who he was in America in some ways, didn't it?
He loved to see himself as a hero. And, of course, he cast himself as a hero coming out of a very chaotic childhood.
Mm-hmm.
That was his way he managed a childhood with an alcoholic father. He moved 20 different times when he was a kid.
Goodness.
His mom took in former prisoners because she was such a do-gooder. And meanwhile, him and his brother were forced to sleep two to a bed. Oh, and by the way, I hate to blow my own horn, but if people think, you know, debate over whether I got Reagan right or Reagan wrong, the fact that Ron Reagan thinks I got Reagan right.
There you go.
But I also point out that Reagan has always been a divisive figure. And the first example I can come up with from the historical record is in his high school yearbook. It's absolutely fascinating. So he was a lifeguard, right? This was his job. And I talk about how it was so important to his sense of self. He even talked about how he felt like a performer up in the lifeguard chair. And in his high school yearbook, there was a kind of a comic dialogue starring Ronald Reagan that one of his classmates wrote. And someone says, someone's drowning in the Rock River where he was the lifeguard. And Ronald Reagan says, "Don't worry, I'll save you." And the character in the dialogue says, "Don't save me, I'm trying to commit suicide." And it's a little morbid, right? These are high school kids.
Right.
And Ronald Reagan responds, "You'll have to postpone that. I want a medal." So this is the division. Half the people think that Ronald Reagan is this great hero and half think he's a phony.
Right?
And I say that you can see this division even among his own children. Maureen, his firstborn, and Michael, who was adopted. Basically, Maureen was a Republican activist. Michael is now a conservative radio commentator.
Mm-hmm.
Look upon him as a hero.
Mm-hmm.
Ron Reagan was kind of too young while this was going on. I think he has a very kind of even approach to him, which is pretty remarkable. And it's remarkable that Michael Reagan forgives his father because, of course, most famously, he didn't even recognize his own son at his high school graduation. But, of course, Patty Davis, you know, the rock and rolling liberal, she wrote a memoir accusing her mom of having beaten her regularly, of having been addicted to pills, and her father being either oblivious or actively hostile to her when she made the accusation. And my favorite story from her memoir is her parents wouldn't pay for her therapy. This is the governor of California, right? The just say no to drugs governor of California, you know, who's making his reputation as a politician by, you know, excoriating the excesses of the 60s. So she has to figure out a way to pay for therapy. You remember how she does it, Kathleen?
No, you tell me.
she bought a pound of marijuana and sold it.
What a story. Well, he also – there was something about you also talk about we both wear glasses, that he really needed to wear glasses.
He did.
But he was so aware of the camera at a certain point that you rarely would see because he realized that, you know, the spotlight was on him. And that guy could weave a tale.
Right.
He could tell a story. He could charm just about anybody. He had the Irish twinkle in his eyes.
Yes. He got the Irish twinkle from his dad, but his mom was a great rhetorician. He imitated how she would speak in church. And yes, he had terrible vision. And but you never see any pictures of him with glasses, except for when he's testifying before HUAC, because he wanted to look serious. But I say that he was as aware of the lines his body presented to the camera as a dancer. He's always watching people watch him.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that ever since he was 10 years old. You can see this kind of inner transformation as reflected in the photographs. And yes, he got glasses. But he was also one of the first people to get contact lenses.
Hmm.
But he couldn't wear them when he was, of course, in his job as a spokesman for GE when he was touring the factories because there was too much, you know, industrial dust. So he would wear his glasses. But no one ever saw him wear glasses. And I only have ever seen one picture after the age of 10 in which he doesn't seem to be aware of the camera and isn't portrayed in a flattering light. And that's this one picture of when he's president and he's wearing these kind of grandpa kind of sweatpants on Air Force One and, you know, reviewing these briefing papers. But he's always, always, always kind of projecting himself in this heroic mold. And it made, again, half the people who saw him feel really good,
right.
Especially amidst kind of these situations that others considered kind of chaotic or a jumble. And he made half the people feel like he was a con artist.
Yeah.
And that, of course, remains
you
today.
You also say at one point that he, and let's talk about this a little bit, he was a very skillful politician and had the ability to see issues mm-hmm. before they would even surface.
That's right.
Which kinds of issues?
Well, there's a specific story I tell in the book which I find quite extraordinary. And it's a real lesson about what separates kind of the men from the boys when it comes to becoming a transformative politician. When he decided that he was going to consider running for governor and started touring around the state of California after he gave his famous speech for Barry Goldwater, which was 50 years ago this week almost, it's October 27th, he started talking about what he called the mess at Berkeley. And you'll recall the mess at Berkeley was the opening innings of the new left, right? The free speech movement, these kids had a sit-in and surrounded a police car after this police car had tried to enforce this law prohibiting political speech on campus. And, of course, this is the movement that eventually kind of becomes the germ of the anti-war movement and is also involved in all kinds of salacious activities, which he would describe with great relish in his speeches. Orgies so vile I can't even describe them to you was one of the best lines. But his handlers, and he had the best, told him, I don't want you – you shouldn't be talking about this stuff. They said, already you have this reputation as a guy who's not smart, this guy who's an actor. They thought about having him announce his candidacy with two Berkeley Nobel Prize winners by his side. And most importantly, and this is the lesson for every politician, excuse me, they said the issue doesn't show up in any of our polls as an issue of concern. And – it's very interesting because a lot of liberals think that Reagan was this completely programmed politician and then he must have had people whispering in his ear all the time telling him what to do and he's just reading a script. Not so at all. He told his advisors to take their polls and go stuff him basically because every time he gave one of these speeches and he just mentioned – or no, he said – if someone asked a question about Berkeley, there would be a standing ovation because there was so much rage among the kind of poor, put upon white middle class of California that these privileged kids were spitting on their privilege. And so he made that an issue. And what he did was he had the emotional intelligence to read a crowd and see what they were interested in.
Hmm.
And the genius of a politician, a great politician, is to kind of sniff out moods that aren't even formulated in terms of political issues yet, right? It's not an issue in polls because people don't know how to think of this as something you can vote about.
Mm-hmm.
But he turned it into that, right? And that was a real piece of political genius. And that's one of the ways, one of the main ways he got elected governor of California. And he was such an underdog and it was such an unlikely story. My favorite example is Esquire magazine, when he won the nomination, said the Republican Party in California can't be that desperate because they haven't nominated Liberace. Right? That's how big a joke he was. And of course, he always ends up getting the last laugh. And then lo and behold, Richard Nixon running for president in 1968 basically steals Ronald Reagan's script. I mean, he could have ran for president in 1966, kind of as he did in 1960, as this kind of sober statesman, you know, kind of splitting the difference in all the issues. But no, he ran as kind of a culture warrior. And that's something he learned directly from Ronald Reagan, which certainly surprised him.
We're going to start taking phone calls in just a moment. And we do want to tell you that Rick's going to be in Milwaukee speaking tonight. It's a fascinating book and era, and he'll go beyond 73 to 76 when he speaks tonight, too. He'll be at the UWM Golden Meyer Library Conference Center, sponsored by Boswell Books, and that's in Milwaukee on the fourth floor tonight at 7 o'clock. His latest book, he's written two others on the conservative movement in this country, is The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. Rick is from Milwaukee, and we have to talk about what happened this week, too, which we'll get to during the course of this hour. To your phone calls momentarily, 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, if you'd like to go to that, is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. We have many of them coming in. Mitch in Green Bay. Hi, Mitch.
Hello. He mentioned all this stuff about Ronald Reagan and being very aware of the photographs and that. I understand that the picture of Ronald Reagan shaking hands with John Wayne Gacy has sort of disappeared. I was wondering if you'd comment about that.
You know, I don't know about that particular issue, but I can definitely tell you that there are lots of unflattering photographs and videos of Reagan that are harder to get a hold of than they used
to
be. Someone is on the case. For example, there's a YouTube video of the Nixon tapes from 1971 in which Kissinger and Nixon start talking about Reagan, and Kissinger or Nixon says, can you imagine Ronald Reagan in this chair? And Nixon's, you know, like Kissinger says, oh, he would start a nuclear war. And they talk about how stupid he is. And, you know, you can go to National Archives and listen to this, and I'm sure it's available somewhere, but you used to be able to get it on YouTube. Someone must have taken it down. There's another picture. I've mentioned that, you know, ever since he was 10 years old and kind of seemed to have worked this inner transformation, all his pictures are – he radiates that kind of inner confidence. Even at these pictures of him at 11, you can recognize him as Ronald Reagan, not just in his physical features but his bearing.
Yes.
But, you know, if you look at the picture of him as a caddy when he's 9, he looks like what he was, which was this terrified, scared, lonely kid. And I cannot find an original of that picture anywhere. So I can't speak to that, but I can speak to the fact that there is a, you know, of course, the Ronald Reagan Legacy project that Grover Norquist started to try and build monuments to Ronald Reagan in every county in America. They wanted to get him on the dime. They wanted to get him on Mount Rushmore. So, and of course, John Wayne Gacy, I think, was a Republican activist in Illinois.
Thanks for the call, Mitch. Pat in Richland Center. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm sure the author has seen and looked at Nixon's resignation speech.
Mm-hmm.
And what's very significant about that is he says in there that there are many that want to spend willy-nilly on the military, which is neither good for this country nor the planet. And it sure, after reading many books about it and everything, looks like Nixon was a man of peace and it was the Pentagon that run him out of town, powerful that run him out of town. And, you know, Kennedy was a man of peace. And, gee, look what happened to him. I mean, and look where the military is now.
All right, Pat, thank you.
Pat, I think you might be referring to Eisenhower's farewell speech in which he talked about the military-industrial complex, which is something you can see on YouTube and is extremely interesting. Eisenhower, you know, two-term president who kind of oversaw the Cold War and America's nuclear buildup, basically was horrified by what he saw. And the speech he gave in January of 1961, right before Kennedy came in, was definitely an inspiration to the student left in the 1960s, and absolutely a fascinating document.
Speaking of pictures, the picture that you have is a perfect picture for Reagan. I mean, he looks like he's about to burst into a Broadway show tune, patriotic, that everybody loves.
And yet he's balancing on the fenders of two cars.
Absolutely.
Like he's
really
the Colossus of Rhodes.
Yeah.
I discovered that picture in a kind of 100th anniversary special edition of Life magazine, which I don't even think publishes, but they apparently have these special editions. I'd never seen it before. It has a couple of interesting features. First of all, it's in the story in the book because this was a visit he made to Tampico, Illinois, which was where he was born. He's standing right in front of the building in which he was born. And by the way, I recently met a guy who bought that building to preserve it, a Democratic activist in Chicago named Wayne Whalen. And if you can look at the picture, it's really fascinating to see how terrified the Secret Service agents are. I mean, this is not that long after Gerald Ford had suffered two assassination attempts within a month. There had been an assassination attempt against him in November of 1975. But he just radiates this confidence. And compare that, Kathleen, to the guy he was running against in 1976 for the Republican nomination, yeah. Gerald Ford.
Why did he do that? I mean, it's kind of rare to take
it
on.
It is incredibly
isn't
rare.
Isn't it somebody in your party who's the president?
Right. If he had won, which he, of course, came within a hair's breadth
yes.
of doing, becoming the nominee in 1976, he would have been the first to do so since Chester Arthur, and you know, beat an incumbent president for the nomination of his own party. And it's very fascinating because by most objective measures, Ford was a pretty conservative president. He was most famous for vetoing every bill he got, you know, to kind of keep down spending. But a lot of it had to do with this idea that Ford kind of, again, to think about Reagan as this hale and hearty physical specimen. Poor Gerald Ford became very famous for bumping into things.
Yeah, but he was really physically fit.
That's right. He was our most athletic president. He was always, you know, skiing circles around the Secret Service men when he went to Vail for his vacations. The one time he fell, though, you know, it became evening news fodder. You know, the first time he fell and became famous for falling was on a rainy day. He was descending down the steep stairs of Air Force One in Salzburg, Vienna. It was raining, and he was helping his wife down the stairs while holding an umbrella. So it was really kind of a bum deal he got.
Right.
And I have a riff about this in the book, which is that kind of his body becomes a symbol of the body politic.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that mm-hmm. everything was going wrong in America kind of became embodied by this image of the bumbling Ford. And that's what Reagan was basically running against. He really only began getting purchase and started winning primaries when he took on a single issue. And that issue, he did terrible when he said we need to, cut spending by $90 billion. He almost, you know, got laughed out of town. But when he said we need to preserve the Panama Canal, right, that was the big issue. And we don't remember this, but
who
this was huge.
That, really?
It was huge in building up the Republican right all the way through 1980. All the senators who voted for the Panama Canal Treaty, like McGovern and Church and Bayh, all get kicked out. And what that issue was about was, of course, the Panama Canal was gunboat diplomacy. The treaty that was signed in 1903 wasn't even read by any Panamanians. It was basically gave America dominion over this third world country. And this was no longer acceptable in the modern world. There had been all sorts of riots in Panama over this. And quietly, you know, ever since the administration of LBJ, the State Department was negotiating a treaty to basically change the terms of this document. Once it kind of the treaty started getting to the home stretch, conservative senators like Strom Thurmond and Jesse Helms got wind of it. And they basically, in this post-Vietnam atmosphere in which people were terrified of the idea of America losing its mojo, said that this was basically the moral equivalent of giving away Topeka, Kansas.
Wow.
Reagan took it on, and he said, we built it, we bought it, it's ours. And it was this kind of macho, America can do no wrong, and how dare we criticize America for neo-imperialism kind of vibe. And he started winning primaries, and suddenly he was the unlucky, luckily hero.
Yeah, he saw the issue. What was the speech that he gave in 1976 in Kansas that was so important?
Right. So basically, the 1976 Republican convention in Kansas was incredibly interesting and a really fun drama to write about, because it was the last one in which the outcome was not known in advance. It was a real contest who would get more delegates and be the nominee. And there's all sorts of intrigue. And there was even factions within the Reagan campaign that wanted Reagan to go further to the right. It was all sorts of stuff. But, you know, to make a long story short, which I hope I do with some aplomb in the book.
You do.
He loses. Basically, he has so many beloved supporters that there's this demand that he give a speech. And Gerald Ford, after he gives his acceptance speech, which is, of course, his introduction to the public and his big TV show, is seen gesturing up to Ronald Reagan, who's sitting in the rafters because they stuck him way out in the boonies so he couldn't kind of stampede the convention, and saying, why don't you come down and give a speech? And Ronald Reagan is seen on TV saying, no, no, waving his arm, shaking his head. And, you know, Ford is saying, please, please. And the crowd is going nuts and finally says, oh, okay. And he tells an aide, oh, I don't even know what I'm going to say. And he comes down and he delivers like a grand slam. And it's this beautiful speech. And it also it foreshadows his courage and foresight in reducing nuclear arms and among other things. And when you watch the YouTube, which you can do, and you can link to it in my my website, because all the notes are linked to videos and documents and newspaper articles, it's like you're watching a church service. People are crying. They're holding hands. And just like in 1964 when he gave his speech for Goldwater, people are saying, maybe we nominated the wrong guy. Uh-huh. Now, the book has a coda, a surprise ending, a twist about that speech, which I'm not going to reveal. You'll have to come to the gig tonight at UWM and buy a copy, which I'll be glad to sign, and you can learn how it ends. But I'm not going to tell you here.
Phone number 800-486-8655. Jim in Rice Lake. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I have 2 points about Reagan. And I mean, he's supposedly credited for reviving the economy and for standing tall and leading to the supposed destruction of the Soviet Empire. The truth of the matter is, I mean, both Clinton and Reagan benefited from the revival of a cyclical economy because Burns and the Fed under the Carter administration kept inflation high. So it choked back the economy. And then Reagan was unpopular in his first term. It was when the economy revived at the end of his first term that he became popular. And the truth of the matter is the destruction of the Soviet Union was arguably the inevitable destruction as a result of the disintegration of their economy. From the containment policy, which started with Truman and actually ended with George Bush. I'll make those comments
yes.
and Thanks. Take my response off, my, the,
thank
off,
you, Jim.
Off the radio.
Okay.
My brother Jim from Bryce Lake, it's a grand slam there. That's absolutely correct, and I completely agree. Let me talk about the Cold War point first. First of all, yes, it was a bipartisan policy started by Truman that defeated the Soviet Union of containment. And the fact of the matter is to say that Reagan ended the Cold War, to me, is kind of a – no, it's not kind of. It's an insult to the brave dissidents in the Soviet Union who risked their lives to open up that system. And, you know, the Soviet Union freed the Soviet Union, right? Just like the slaves freed themselves by, you know, leaving the plantations. And there's a couple of important points about that. The space that was opened up for those dissidents to be able to do that was created by the policy of détente, which was basically the policy that Nixon was campaigning against in 1976 and 1980. Now, Reagan did have the courage and the foresight to negotiate with Mikhail Gorbachev and open up that possibility. And Gorbachev, of course, is also a hero of this story. But the fact of the matter is when it happened, conservatives excoriated Reagan. You know, George Will was absolutely savage. He was selling out to the communists. So the other point I would make about the economy, it's absolutely true. The important figure is Paul Volcker, who was the Federal Reserve chair that was nominated by Carter in order to kind of break the back of inflation with the mandate of inducing a recession. And Ronald Reagan endorsed that policy when he became president by reappointing Volcker. Of course, Jimmy Carter knew that even if he did this, he would probably be screwing himself out of a second term as president because this would only happen a couple of years later. And that's exactly what did happen. The Republicans did terrible in the off-year elections in 1982 because unemployment was still 10%. But by 1984, the cycle had swung back. The economy was booming. And Ronald Reagan won 49 states by blaming it all on Jimmy Carter. And his opponent was Jimmy Carter's vice president, Walter Mondale, who he called Vice President Malaise.
Scott in La Crosse is next. Hey, Scott.
Hey there, Kathleen. I'm enjoying the show immensely.
Good.
I was interested when you brought up Ron Reagan Jr.'s book.
Mm-hmm.
I remember calling in during that program and asking Ron Jr. if he thought whether he thought his father could get the nomination to be president in today's Republican Party, and he said that's pretty doubtful.
Right.
And so I guess my question is, what you think President Ronald Reagan would make of the Tea Party in today's political arena. And then before I let you answer that, just my quick bit of business on the Panama Canal.
Mm-hmm.
I think I remember reading at some point that at the time that we sold, that the U.S. gave the Panama Canal back to Panama, it was actually losing money.
Well, there were lots. There were lots of good reasons to give it up. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it was not. Basically, you know, like the argument was, well, we have to have it so our, you know, kind of warships can go through it. Well, it was too small for warships to go through.
Right.
You know, it wasn't a good business proposition. Shipping was being superseded by air freight. It was all kinds of reasons, strategic, economic. But the reason that the Ford administration didn't, and all these senators didn't account for, was this idea of national pride. You know, the Panama Canal was something we read about as school kids, that America kind of tamed the jungle and all that. And the question about what Reagan would make of today's Republican Party is something I've been asked every time I've done a call-in or done a presentation about this. And my interpretation is a little different from most folks. I write a lot as a journalist about the Republican Party and the conservative takeover of the Republican Party. And I am a historian who sees mostly continuities between the conservative movement from the 1950s to the present. Now, the Republican Party has changed a great deal because the conservatives, you know, have largely taken it over. But if you look at Ronald Reagan's rhetoric, and his rhetoric changes between 1976 when he runs in 1980, mainly because he's basically disciplining himself a lot more and you know, reading speeches more than just kind of speaking off the cuff. But his rhetoric when he wasn't running for president on the radio, when he was a radio personality in 1975 and 1977, 1978, was quite extreme. And the fact of the matter is, when you're president or when you're governor, because he also achieved a lot as a governor that conservatives would disagree with, you basically don't get to choose your policies that you want to implement off the shelf or off a catalog. You have to deal with the political cards that you're given. And the fact of the matter is, the political culture was much further to the left then than it is now. So you see Ronald Reagan doing things like signing the most liberal abortion law in the country in 1967. And the reason he does that is because it seems like he has to for his political survival. You see Ronald Reagan doing things like signing tax hikes, both as governor and as president. And in both cases, he had to do that because he was dealing with a liberal majority in the legislature. If he had his druthers, he would have governed quite differently. If Richard Nixon had had his druthers, he would have governed quite differently. We talk about all the liberal things that Richard Nixon signed, you know, OSHA and the Clean Water Act and the EPA and things like that. The fact of the matter is, when he was reelected and he had free rein to do what he did in that narrow window before Watergate completely swallowed up his administration. If you look at the budget he was trying to pass for 1974, it was basically the most conservative budget ever. He wanted to completely reverse the Great Society. So people talk about Richard Nixon as the last liberal president. They talk about Ronald Reagan as this kind of crypto-liberal. It's just that politicians have to deal with the hand that they're dealt.
Thank you very much, Scott, for the call. Except for his relationship with unions, that you can sort of see that thread starting with him and really being a thread that's been around in the conservative movement for some time.
Complexly enough, there's a really good book by a historian at Georgetown named Joseph McCartan about the firing the air traffic controllers. And Ronald Reagan, actually, after he fired the air traffic controllers and broke that union, very quietly let them build a new union. So he, you know, he did believe in collective bargaining rights, even though he fought, you know, union power pretty fiercely ever since he became a conservative, which was a complicated process I talk about in the book too.
So weave the history, and we'll get back to the book. But I want you to comment on the election that we just had 2 days ago,
right,
where there was a huge conservative sweep in the
right
country. It would appear to me. Do we learn anything from this era, and it's applicable to today, or how do you interpret what happened?
Well, I could write a whole book, of course.
Yeah, well,
it's complicated.
I hope you will.
And, you know, if you look at my journalism, you can, you know, Google me and read tons of stuff about this. But the main – and also you can friend me on Facebook. I have a very lively community and we have lots of great discussions.
I'll bet you do.
But the the main thing that happened in the last election was we're discovering that the electorate in these off-year elections and the electorate in presidential years are just completely different electorates. Mm. I mean, there's an absolutely fascinating, riveting chart of the percentage of voters who are over 30 and the percentage of voters who are over, I think, 60 or maybe 70. I can send it to you, Kathleen. Mm-hmm. And it's like a sawtooth. You know, it's like basically you have overwhelmingly over 70 in off-year elections and overwhelmingly over 30, although under 30, although even in presidential years, they don't vote at very high rates. The old people always vote.
Yeah.
You know, the lowest rate of old people voting is higher than the highest rate of young people voting. And so that's why we see these situations where Barack Obama wins two presidential elections, but this other older, whiter electorate, which bothers to show up, and richer, by the way, who bothers to show up for the polls in these congressional elections, wins the off-year elections. Now, the other important part of this formula is the media. And the conservative movement and the Republican Party, which is very good at announcing, and Ronald Reagan was great at this after every election, a mandate for conservatism every time. Even though if you look at it by an issue-by-issue basis, and this was very striking this year where you saw so many minimum wage initiatives winning as the same electorate voted in conservatives, issue-by-issue, people are not operationally conservative. But the Republican Party is very good at saying, this proves that the electorate is conservative, and because of this, I'm going to, well, if you're President Bush, try to privatize Social Security, or if you're Scott Walker, decertify collective bargaining. And the media kind of eats it up, right? Mm-hmm. They kind of the mainstream political press has kind of bought this narrative that, A, the Republican Party has matured and that this new Congress is going to be much more mature and responsible, even though I think there's no evidence of that, and that they have a mandate to govern the country. But of course, we switch back every 2 years.
Right.
So there's all sorts of other things I can say to you. But I'll let the listeners kind of take the hand.
This hour, we're talking about 1973 to 1976 and before and beyond with the preeminent historian of the conservative movement. Rick Perlstein is our guest. His latest book is The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. And we do he's from Milwaukee, Rick is, and he's going to be talking about this book tonight. You're welcome to hear him. I'm sure it'll be a great evening. UWM Goldemeyer Library Conference Center on the fourth floor, and it's tonight at 7 o'clock. More phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls for Rick. Gene in Big Bend is next. Hey, Gene.
Good afternoon. I'm interested in finding out whether Mr. Perlstein has some clue of why he used the name Dutch Reagan when he was a sports announcer with the WHO in Des Moines in the middle 30s, telling us about the Cub scheme from telegraphic reports.
Right. That opens us up to a very fascinating kind of biographical detail about Ronald Reagan, which is that he would tell the same stories about his life in very different ways, and often they would contradict each other. We know Ronald Reagan was a great storyteller, right, which is a generous way of putting it. One story he gives is that when he was born, he screamed so loudly and was so plump and red that his dad, Jack Reagan, the hail fellow well-met Irishman, said he screams like a little Dutchman, and I don't know what particular ethnic stereotype he was pulling from. And he would sometimes tell another story, which was that once him and his brother had long hair and his dad marched them off to the barber, and his brother got the nickname Moon because he looked like the cartoon character Moon Mullins, and he was known as Moon until his death. And Ronald Reagan was called Dutch because he looked like a little Dutch boy. And Ronald Reagan would tell both these stories, which clearly kind of contradict each other. And then I got another testimony that he gave himself the name and that someone he grew up with doesn't remember him being called Dutch at all. But he definitely told people to call him Dutch. He thought it was more manly. He thought Ronald was a very wimpy name. And it, of course, became his professional name when he was a radio broadcaster, famously broadcasting the Cubs game via telegraph and filling in the story, right? Filling in the kind of making it seem like he was there at the ballpark, such that his radio colleagues, when he made it to Hollywood in 1937, the Hollywood guys thought Dutch Reagan wouldn't look good on the marquee. And when they saw this guy, Ronald Reagan, they weren't even sure it was the same guy.
Thanks very much for the call. But I don't want the hour to leave before we get to a lot of the substance here, what the decision that we're looking at, mm-hmm. as to whether or not we need to examine our history and
I think we do need to examine our history.
be critical of the things that aren't very good about right. America rather than embracing this shining city right. on the hill, this optimism, which Reagan did embrace.
Right.
What is it about the American character that makes us want to go that direction? Because
right.
he was president for 8 years, and
right.
people, even Democrats now, have
right.
this optimism, too, about how great America is, the shining city, the best country in the world, et cetera.
Right. I think it's easy, right? I mean, it's the easier route, right? I mean, who wants to dwell in negativity? And unfortunately, it's easy, but it's also, you know, irresponsible. And just so I can sort of give people a sense of how deep this is within our political culture and how beyond the level of policy and the size of government that we're so deeply Reaganite on the level of rhetoric, I tell a story in the preface about how Samantha Power, the great human rights activist who wrote The Problem from Hell, a book about genocide, a very negative book, had written an article earlier in her career about the crimes that American foreign policy was responsible for, which I think is true. You know, I think we're strong enough to face up to the fact that we've made mistakes and move on from them. And when she was asked about that article and asked specifically by Marco Rubio, the Republican from Florida, who was a presidential aspirant, what crime she was referring to, she had to respond in order to become a public official, in order to become Barack Obama's United Nations ambassador. America is the greatest country in the world, and we don't have to apologize for anything.
Hmm. Greg in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Greg.
Yes, I'm wondering about the relationship between Ronald Reagan and his father-in-law.
We can barely hear you.
But
so
I got that.
You
yeah.
got it. Okay.
He asked about the relationship between Ronald Reagan and his father-in-law. So, of course, he had two father-in-laws. He was married twice, our first divorced president. I don't know anything about Jane Wyoming's father. But Nancy Reagan, not born Nancy Davis. Actually, she was born Nancy Luckett. Her father, her stepfather. It's a very tangled story. Basically, her mother was an itinerant actress. Down on her luck, and she fell in love with a very prominent physician after her divorce named Royal Davis. He was kind of one of the aristocrats of Chicago society and became head of surgery at Northwestern University. And Nancy Reagan identified with him so deeply that she actually went to a judge on her own and arranged for herself to be adopted by him, and then basically didn't even acknowledge that she that this guy was her stepfather and not her real father when she was asked directly about it. So she was kind of Reaganite in that way too. But the important point to remember about Loyal Davis was that he was very conservative and he was active in national conservative politics. He was friends with the Goldwaters. He vacationed in Phoenix. And he had a big influence on Ronald Reagan's journey to the right in the 1950s, which is something I write about in the book.
Hmm. Interesting. Thank you very much, Greg, for the call. Well, thank you so much for being
with
us.
Such a pleasure.
And people ask, but I'll ask anyhow, how it is that this particular time in interest has so captivated you, the rise of conservatism. I mean, you've become the
right.
preeminent historian for this.
I've told this story on so many radio stations around the country, but this means so much to this audience. I can pin it all in the Renaissance bookstore.
That's great.
Because I just was so obsessed with kind
bookstore.
Of rooting through the basement and reading old magazines, and I became so obsessed with the
60s. Oh, Rick.
And that's where it comes from, really.
Oh, I'm sorry it's not there for you anymore.
It's okay. You know, this too must pass.
I guess so. Thank you very much. Have a really good time tonight. I'm sure you
great.
Will.
I'll see y'all.
Yeah, and we'll tell you more about it in a moment. Rick Perlstein, the book is The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. He's written two other books, too, which we should tell you the names of because maybe you've read some of them or you should. Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America, a New York Times bestseller. And before that, Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus. Rick will tonight be at the UWM Goldemeyer Library Conference Center on Hartford Avenue. Avenue on the fourth floor. That's tonight at 7 o'clock, and you're invited to that event. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour. Thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up momentarily. We'll next be with you on Monday for All Things Political at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, where we'll take a look at the elections and why people voted the way they did. So that's coming up next week. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network.